Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Once a month, Mayor Vi Lyles is on the program. She is back with us this morning, and we have a ton of things to talk about, from her tie-breaking vote to bring Greg Phipps back to City Council, the transit plan in which a wrinkle has recently unfolded, to the arrival in town of $27 million in COVID relief, and there is more, so let us dive right in. Welcome back. Good to see you.
Good morning, everyone. Mike, thanks for having me again.
You're welcome. Thank you for being with us. I know you have a busy schedule today. Thanks for not canceling. I appreciate it. After receiving applications from 100 eligible applicants to fill James Mitchell's at-large seat on City Council, they were narrowed down to two, community advocate Jessica Davis and Greg Phipps, who once represented District 4 on Council. And the vote was, well, contentious for reasons that we'll talk about, but in the end it was decided that Greg Phipps would get the seat, and you cast the tie-breaking vote. You said that this was a very difficult decision. So why did you choose Mr. Phipps?
Well, it was difficult because for the first time in my recent history, we had over 140 people that were interested in a position. That's unprecedented. So I'm really grateful that people are much more aware of what our business is and how we work, and that they want to participate. So just the volume was something that was really difficult. And then to look and think about what choices we would make, the council adopted a process, and that process was approved by everyone. And going forward, I just think it was unprecedented that we would have the number of people. But the bottom line, you asked why. I chose Mr. Phipps. One, I chose him because as a former budget director for the city and currently as mayor, on Wednesday after that Monday decision, we were going to have a budget workshop. And Mr. Phipps had been on the council more recently, understood the policies that we were dealing with right now. His expertise in finance and planning made a big difference to me. And so that's why I chose him. I mean, he's got a great record all the way from developing the Prosperity Church land use plan to the idea of how we do our debt financing. That made a difference. Now, I also want to say that Jessica Davis is an exceptional candidate, and I hope that she would think about how she could stay involved politically as well as with the community. I sent her a note basically saying this wasn't about saying no to someone, even though there had to be someone to say no, that you couldn't do, everybody couldn't be a part of this. But I just felt that we were ready to move faster with Mr. Phipps and what the issues that we were dealing with and our strategic priorities.
Had Jessica Davis and Greg Phipps not emerged as the two front runners, were there others among the 98 remaining people who applied that you thought had potential for being on council?
Absolutely. And some of them, I do not know. I really don't know at all. But there is a young woman in Steel Creek, Margis, I believe is her name. She was exceptional. I mean, when you looked at what she talked about and what she wanted to do and how she wanted to serve, and she has followed up with an email to me. So I'm hopeful to reach out to her soon to say, stay encouraged, stay involved, and continue on this journey. There were other members of the council that had other people that were just as well considered in terms of their skills and their abilities to come to the table. But the decision, as I said, it's difficult. It was very, very difficult, but one that the council had to make.
So there was an earlier bone of contention about whether or not whoever was chosen would agree not to run again in November. Was that solved? I know that I think Greg Phipps has promised Malcolm Graham, who put his name in nomination, that he would not run again in November. I'm sure he doesn't have to stick to that. There's no law that says he can't, but has that been solved?
You know, that cannot be a criteria. We cannot require someone to do that. And I think that that's kind of one of those things that an individual council member may consider in their decision making, maybe in their one-to-one conversations. But I know that Mr. Phipps has said he would not run. So did Ms. Davis. So those were equal in the and I think in terms of weight. But I just want people in this community to know that that's not a requirement. if you want to run, you can make that choice. It's always a choice to get involved. And that choice lies with the individual resident of our community. So it was a consideration in some people's decision making. It is something that I think is raised as a question, but not one that I believe we can require. And for me, I've learned that people change and they get involved and engaged and they make different decisions. I know that that has happened in the past, and it's likely that it will continue to be something that individually people decide on.
One bone of contention this time around was bringing Greg Phipps back, who's been on council before and has the experience that you said would be valuable in the coming weeks as the budget process begins because of his past positions with the city and on council. But the other criticism was the fact this was an opportunity to bring new ideas, new blood onto council. Put that into perspective. What would have been lost had you taken that path?
I feel like a smile when you say bring new ideas. We have lots of new ideas, and this is not the only door that's open to those new ideas. We have hundreds of people engaged on our boards and commissions, and they have a report that they can send to us. There's lots of open and community engagement. Almost every council member has a town hall meeting. So new ideas are out there all the time. And I hope that there's not one single way to get new ideas on the table. And then I think about, you know, the biggest issue that we have on the table now is upward mobility. And what we've done in affordable housing in the last 3 years is significantly different than what we were doing 5 years ago. And then this mobility plan that we have that addresses the issue of upward mobility and the cost of moving from home to work, these are new ideas. These are things that are very progressive. We're leading in this country. I think Austin is the only other city that has a mobility plan written like ours, being discussed like, well, theirs has been approved by their electorate, but their residents. But I think new ideas are out there. And I'm very happy that our council is open and receptive to many pathways, many doorways to come through with those ideas.
Let's talk about process just for a couple of seconds here. Because of COVID, there was a virtual candidate forum that preceded this vote. I think all of the candidates had an opportunity to speak to council on Zoom, I guess, for 2 minutes each. Greg Phipps chose not to participate in that, but there was no opportunity for the public to weigh in on those candidates after they had their say, and that has raised transparency issues among some. Was this process transparent as it could have been, or as transparent as it was in the past when this has had to happen, when council voted on temporary replacements?
So I want to go to the idea, to a couple of things. One, Greg Phipps did not meet the deadline. It's not that he chose not to, he just didn't meet the deadline. And then once you do that, we're very strict. If the deadline is this date, you can't come in late. We can't do that, because otherwise we'd never close out anything. The second thing that I think is that we had a discussion when we adopted the process about the idea of video, and the council said, well, you know, it's Friday. If you can't get there, you have the opportunity to send something individually to each council member. And so in some ways it was consistent with the process that the council approved, that you did not have to do this, but people chose, and there were almost 70 people chose to spend those 2 minutes speaking about their vision for the city. And I think that was very helpful and very transparent for their ability to express to the full council for those 3 hours what they saw. And the notes that I took with the paper resumes that were sent in were invaluable. So when we talk about this, it was a council decision. It was more transparent and more process oriented than prior decisions, which basically were done by the council completely. So I think it opens up. Do we have room to open more? I'm really excited if there's opportunity to do this again, that we continue to look at what the residents said about transparency and put that into the process in a different way.
And yet some council members argued that the outcome was predetermined, that Greg Phipps was always the guy. And they questioned why council went through the motions of taking applications at all. Some have characterized the process as giving the illusion of democracy. One community advocate, Christy Puckett Williams, said they want to give the illusion of democracy, but true democracy doesn't mind engaging in the democratic process. What would you say to her and to other members of council who feel that this wasn't the right way to do it?
I would say that true democracy comes with the November elections. We're all going to be out there working hard for our community. There are going to be people that I think for the first time, what I saw was such an interest and an overwhelming interest of those over 140 applications for those seats that are going to be open. There are going to be 11 seats open for the city council this fall. And I would just hope that what people saw in that process, they would continue to see. Now, if you applied for that vacancy and see yourself as someone that could make a contribution, as I said, run for office, make sure that you get the understanding of what the governance structure is and who, what you want to do. And if that's not something that you're willing to do, there are so many other opportunities. There's so many organizations in this community that help government be successful. Our boards and commissions, but a lot of not-for-profit organizations. A lot of this is open. So if it was just this one seat, I'd be a little bit concerned about this. But there are so many other ways to serve this community. I hope everybody in that over 140 group would say, here's a way that I can commit to service.
Councilman Braxton Winston did not support either of the finalists in this selection process. He said that City Council has not discussed the merits of the applicants that came before us. Was there no discussion before a vote was taken? And is that an unfair criticism, I guess, is the question.
I think that is something that I thought Mr. Winston said, and I can't address whether he engaged in discussions or not. I know that the council members did have discussions, and I know that they were often, I think Mayor Pro Tem Isaac called everyone and said, let's talk about this in a way that helps us with the process and making the decision. But I also think that Mr. Winston said something else. He said that he would not support someone who had lost in a primary, a Democratic primary. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the reasons that he said he would not support a candidate, whomever that was going to be. And then there was another caveat to his vote that reflected in his voting no for each person.
Does council look at budget process every year, or is it every other year?
No, it's every year. I think it's every week.
So,
I say that because we adopt a major strategic plan by state law, but every week we're making decisions on how to implement that plan.
So let me ask you this, because it's been said, you just said, that one of the strengths that Greg Phipps brings to this is his experience working with the budget, and you're about to go into the budget process, but every 2 years there's a new council. And that you come into office in December and you go through the budget process in February. So there's not much of a difference between the end of December and where we are right now versus where Greg Phipps is right now and where the budget process begins. So what's that 1 month difference going to mean? Because Jessica could have gotten that
to 1 month
speed, right?
Difference is hours and hours of orientation by the city manager about the budget. So December, when new members are elected, they spend days learning about how the structure works and the budget structure. And most of the time, by that time, when you talk about transparency, almost every person that has won in that office has had a community discussion from the time that they file in July all the way through the election, that they have to go through some primaries. Some people have primaries. But the election, you're talking about those kinds of issues openly. And I believe that's the most significant part of what we have to do. Vote in November for the people that you want to serve.
There's money coming in the form of COVID relief. There's a little wrinkle in the transit plan, as one might have anticipated, I suppose. And we'll talk about those and other things with Mayor Vi Lyles when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles is with us, as she is once a month, or she endeavors to be once a month, and she's here this morning with us. But one final question about the selection of Greg Phipps to be on City Council to replace James Mitchell, and then we'll move on to other topics. Mr. Mitchell, when he resigned because there was a conflict of interest that cropped up when he got a new job, he recommended Jessica Davis to be his replacement. He was council's longest serving and therefore probably most experienced council member. But council ignored his, or at least you did, because you broke the record. You had the tie-breaking vote. You ignored his recommendation. What should we read into that?
I think you should not use the word ignore, Mike. I did not ignore his recommendation. I had a conversation with Jessica Davis. I've read all of those applications, made lots of notes through them. And what I would say about this is about, as we were moving as a council, how I thought best the person would best serve us for this interim period. As I said, I think James Mitchell, as his representation first on the West Side and then overall in this community, made a huge impact, and I'm really grateful for his service. As we are continuing to move forward and getting through up until the filing period in July and then going to the election, I just felt like this was the best decision.
Well, let's move on to something else and something needed in the community. COVID has, as we all know, has caused great pain and suffering. People in business, people who have lost jobs, people who are struggling to pay rent and put food on the table. And the good news is that they're going to get some federal rent relief. City Council on Monday directed nearly $27 million to that end. Is this new money? Or money that came in during the last days of the Trump administration, which has been waiting to be assigned? What is this money? Where's it coming from?
Well, this money is from the federal government. It is part of the work that we're doing, or the federal government is doing. If you look at unemployment, as you said, if you look at people trying to prevent homelessness, keeping people in their housing when they have no job to be able to afford their rent or utility payments. So this $27 million came to the city through our community development federal funding, and which is all about housing and keeping people housed. So this $27 million is expected to help over 15,000 people with their utility bills. Because I think one of the headlines that I read in one of our local paper said that, the cost of heating your home is going up so fast that we need to get this money out so that these folks first have the ability to pay for their utilities and stay warm during this winter. But it's also going to help over 5,000 households with rent assistance. So I hope that you'll give me just a moment to say, if you are in this situation where you need help with your utility bills or help with your rent, if you would go to RAMPCLT.com, this program is available to people that need assistance, that are impacted by COVID and lost their opportunities to be able to afford their housing or their utility bills. If you will go to RAMPCLT.com and make an application, this money is to go out to help the people that live in Charlotte.
And that's RAMP, R-A-M as in Michael, P as in Patrick, C-L-T. Yeah. What are the eligibility requirements, and what do you have to do to prove that you meet those requirements?
Well, we try to make it very simple, but the major requirement is that your loss of income has to be COVID-related, which I don't think is a very high bar given our industries right now, especially in our hospitality industries, especially where people have small businesses. So when you're doing that, if you can look at what we require, very simple application, but the major requirement is it has to be COVID related.
And how quickly do people need to apply before $27 million runs out? Is there a
I can't recall the amount of that we've spent in prior. I think it was around $20 to $30 million we did when we were in the midst of all of this in February. And mm-hmm. that money was able to serve not just people with rental assistance. We helped with homelessness, with the acquisition and leasing of hotels and motels. We also contributed $2 million to Roof Above, because they were going to make an acquisition for a single room occupancy building. And they really quickly moved to provide a temporary shelter as well as begin to renovate that facility that they purchased. So this money moves quickly, but at the same time, it's moving for the right reasons quickly. It's keeping people in their housing or providing housing for the homeless.
A lot of the people who may need this the most may not have a computer or internet access and may not know that this money is available or where to go to get it. So are there alternatives to rampclt.com? And how is the message getting out?
You know, one of the ways that we started in February and is that we began to work with the court system as eviction notices were being done before the eviction moratoriums were being done. And we have asked our community relations committee, as well as our community development team that's led by Pam Weidman, to actually look at where those legal filings are going and taking place, but also to ask our neighborhood associations to get out. And we have a flyer basically saying, here are the protections that you have under this moratorium that we try to distribute. But I think that when you look at the nonprofits that we have worked with historically, think about crisis assistance. They now have the ability, when people ordinarily know in the rental community that they can go to crisis assistance, crisis assistance has the ability to say, this is what you have to do, and assist them in getting that done.
Mayor Vi Lyles is our guest today. Once a month, she comes on the program and we talk about all the things that have been going on. There's a lot going on. Late last year, the Charlotte Moves Task Force unveiled an ambitious transit plan that will cost billions of dollars and will require a tax hike, a sales tax hike, certainly maybe a property tax hike. This is going to require buy-in from the legislature. It's going to require buy-in from communities surrounding Charlotte. And a couple of weeks ago, the Lake Norman Chamber of Commerce, in an open letter published in Cornelius Today, said simply no. They brought up the slow burn that a lot of folks in that area have had over voting yes for the previous tax increase for transit and thinking that they've gotten nothing in return for that except toll lanes, which they didn't want in the first place. And the problem with this commuter rail line from downtown Charlotte into Huntersville, Davidson, and Cornelius has always been Norfolk Southern and getting right-of-way on their rail line, because that's the only, and either the only way we can do this or the most convenient and cheapest way to do it. They've always said no, not interested. But now the Red Line has emerged as a priority for that region. It wasn't part of the Charlotte Moves plan for all the reasons we talked about. How much of an obstacle does this pose?
Well, you know, I think that, one, there are parts of this that are really so process or logistical oriented, and that's our relationship between the railroads and our transit plan. So that's part of it. But the other part of it is the ability to work together as a region, because if we can't go north, we are not going to be able to get to Cabarrus. We've got to figure out some ways to do this, and I think that the towns have expressed very clearly their concern with the lack of effort in terms of commuter rail or mass transit efforts. So we're having to really work with them to say, what is it that we can do? Because doing nothing is I just think, not an option for us. When we look at our growth, if we are doing nothing, then what we're saying is we're willing to have more cars on our highways and our roads, more poor air quality, more issues around commuting into work, and lack of connection of jobs and housing. So when I think about this, what we have to have is a better conversation, a deeper conversation about how to resolve some of these issues that have come up. And we're working, you know, diligently on this. You know, Mike, I really have to say that when you look at the size of our city and what we have to do to move people between home and work and have the opportunity for people that live where there are no jobs to get to work in a reasonable amount of time, the option, we have a plan that was supported by the task force, but we also need to think about, well, what happens if we do nothing? Because I just don't see that as a way to be a fast-growing city that's responsive to the ability to recruit new companies and new businesses with great jobs for the people that live here.
But you have this big stumbling block. It's called a desire on the part of people in the northern part of the county for something in return for their tax dollars, which they felt they did not get the first time around. And the fact that Norfolk Southern has said, not so much. We're not interested. But then at City Council on Monday night, it was presented by the city of Charlotte that this will be a focal point of getting this through. City Planner Assistant City Manager Taiwo Jayoba has said that the red line could see traction if the General Assembly approves the sales tax increase. How? If Norfolk Southern isn't on board, how?
You know, Norfolk, those lines are intricately connected by contract with the North Carolina Railroad. These are very statutory roles that we have here. And I agree. I think that while we have the ability to have a vision for what we need to do, I'm not saying it's an easy road to get it done. I think, though, if we don't talk about it, nothing gets done. And so we've got to figure something out. So we have to continuously think, how do we get a relationship with the Northern community? How do we have a relationship that makes it possible? And that means Norfolk Southern, we have to continue to work with. Just like any negotiation, people have their positions and we have our interests. Our interest is to have a county, a region that gets people employed and housed. And that means we have to have mobility to move them around. And that's our interest. And I hope that that's the railroad's interest, because we are just as much of an economic driver for railroad and logistics. When you start thinking about the future of this, you know, and I know railroads have been around for a very long time, but change is coming. So I hope that they'll see that they have an interest, even though they have a position right now that they're not doing it, they should have an interest in getting this solved.
Taiwo Jayoba alluded to the fact that there's new leadership at Norfolk Southern, and that might open the door. Norfolk Southern recently said nothing has changed. Am I hearing you say that you, the city, and the legislature might put pressure on them, threaten them in some way, to make them say yes to this?
I am not saying that. Let me tell you what I am exactly saying. I'm saying anyone that cares about this region and cares about the opportunity for us to participate in a way that we grow this region the way we choose to do it should have an interest in solving this problem with the with transit and mobility. And that's what I'm saying. So if you want to drop out of the conversation, then I understand that. But if you want to be a part of a solution, you have to come to the table. I saw the quote from Norfolk Southern, and that's a position statement, not an interest statement.
Okay.
So what are we interested in getting done?
Why would they care?
Well, I do believe that railroads still make money. I do believe that as they're making this money, how do they fit in the idea of logistics as we look at how goods and services are going to be delivered across this country, but particularly in our region, how do we make sure that the port of Wilmington and Savannah and Charleston get goods to where we expect to be a huge logistics hub in the future to our region? And so there's interest in a lot. There are lots of things that we can see in the future that require us to have a really good mobility plan. And I believe that the railroads understand that. Every part of our community should understand that.
So are there no other options? Have we determined that the only way to do commuter rail is to use their track, their right of way? There's no other way to do this?
Now you're getting way above my pay grade.
And the other question is
the railroad planner or the engineer types. I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, and the other question is, the transit plan that was proposed by Charlotte Moves is a multimodal plan. It's not just rail, although light rail is certainly the largest piece of it, and it goes from Matthews to Belmont. And the total price tag is somewhere, and we know it'll be higher than this, but at the moment, it is somewhere between $8 and $12 billion. Whereas the commuter rail portion of this, we are told, would come in around $600 million. Why the price difference? That's an enormous price difference.
Because you already have track for the commuter rail if Northern Southern allows us to run both of those both types of service on that track, whereas the Silver Line is actually new service, much like the Blue Line, which would be light rail. And so that's the difference in the cost. I also think that if you watched our meeting on Monday, you saw the cost difference in roads as well. We now project a road to be up to $75 million, and we expect intersections to be $25 to $30 million. So when you think about the improvements that are required for us to actually move, again, the goal is to get people moving from home to work and work to home, is that it's a tremendous amount of money. And yes, but the $4 billion that would be raised by the 1% sales tax really is going to, we would hope to have the infrastructure bill coming out of the federal administration. I read Pete Buttigieg, the new Secretary of Transportation's comments after he was sworn in, and infrastructure for mobility and mobility in the future is a high priority for his office, and I believe the Biden administration. It didn't get accomplished under the prior administration, and we have the opportunity with a mobility plan to create a better future for everyone, create jobs for the people that build and construct it. So I think there's some momentum there. So when we get to this level of work, I would hope that we are ready with our 1% sales tax to match the federal match that will be required for a transportation project. And the silver line is at 50%, I believe, preparation. And the red line we're going to pull and make sure that it can compete as well.
So 5 years ago, as everybody knows, unless you're a newcomer here, Charlotte passed a non-discrimination ordinance protecting LGBTQ rights and allowing the use of restrooms in government-owned buildings on the basis of gender identity. And that was immediately slapped down by the General Assembly. They passed HB 2, ending the ordinance. And then they passed HB 142 that disallowed local communities from passing anything similar to what Charlotte had done for 5 years. Well, the time is up. That bill has expired, or that part of the bill has expired. And Hillsborough, Carrboro, Chapel Hill, Durham, Greensboro, and Orange County have passed non-discrimination ordinances. Mecklenburg County just unanimously passed a non-binding resolution inviting towns here to pass their own ordinances and make them enforceable. Charlotte was first to the table last time. We seem to be taking a more cautious approach this time. I'm going to ask you a bunch of questions about that and what's in the hopper in that area when we come back after the break. Mayor Vi Lyle is our guest on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyle is our guest for the hour, and we have a lot to cover in this next short amount of time, including the ordinances that are being passed around the state for LGBTQ rights. We were first into the breach last time. This time, we've taken a more cautious approach. Do we have anything? Is council looking at anything along those lines, Mayor?
Of course, we are. We were first, and you remind me, Mike, that this happened under when Dan Clodfelter was mayor and Michael Barnes was the mayor pro tem. I was on the council, and I remember going through a series of motions and votes. And the closest that we could get was the ordinance that we would actually have the ability to implement now was defeated by one vote back in 2014 or 15. It may have been 2015 under Dan Clodfelter. I was on the side that did not get approval. And I remember having the conversation with Michael Barnes and saying, this is something we need to do. And I believe that. And I believe that we as a community are committed to, we're going to have diversity and we're going to have equity and equality in what we're doing for our residents and our visitors. We suffered in so many ways, the loss of conferences, the loss of the All-Star Game, if you'll recall that, and the PGA, all of those things where the national trend was much further ahead than we were by one vote, one vote. And so this matters to me because we need to do it in a way that we can have an ordinance that is creates the equitable treatment for everyone, and that we need to do this in a way that we can enforce it. So I know that individual council members are beginning to talk about what the ordinance actually says, how do we enforce it, because we don't want to pass a non-binding resolution. We want to adopt something that is realistic and enforceable And so we know that this is an important issue for our on our agenda, and we're working on it, and we will become, it'll come up in the next several months, I believe.
I believe I'm correct in saying that the legislature still prohibits what Charlotte tried to achieve with bathrooms. You can't do that.
That is not something that we're allowed to do. But as I said, the ordinance, when we were having this debate and doing the issues around what people were considering the bathrooms, which it's kind of ironic when you look at it today, almost every building that I go into is gender free in terms of bathrooms in our city, maybe not everywhere, but in our city. And so what I think that what we're doing is what the state legislation allows us to do, and we're going to do that.
So the previous ordinance, my brain is foggy on this, but the previous ordinance was strongly supported by one of your predecessors, Jennifer Roberts, and I think it could be safely argued that she lost that position because of her strong support for that and what happened as a result of that statewide. Is that making people on council more cautious, making you more cautious? And I ask because Senate Leader Phil Berger seems to be taking a different tack this time around, seeming to be willing to leave anything that comes up as a result of these ordinances to the courts to decide and not the legislature.
Well, I appreciate that. I think that if Senator Berger is president of our Senate, says that it's up to the courts, then that gives us the leeway to do what we have the legislative authority to do. And I'm glad that he's taking that position, because I believe that at some point throughout all of this process, it is about what we eventually do as a country. Charlotte wants to be in a place where we can represent to our residents that they're safe, that they are going to be treated fairly. And I believe that if North Carolina can get to that place, if the senator has gotten to that place, that's better for us in Charlotte.
You also are going to need the cooperation of the legislature for your transit package. And I'm wondering if you are taking a more cautious approach, or if you will take a more cautious approach, because you don't want to tick off these people up in Raleigh who already don't love us very much. You want to keep them on your side for that.
You know, Mike, these are issues that are very meaningful in terms of our values, both on creating opportunity for people as well as making sure that people are treated with equality. So there, what I'm saying is that those two things are not connected. We're not going to trade on our values. We're going to approach this that we have the authority to do it. We're going to have a way that's enforceable in our community. And we're also going to try to get a referendum so that we can plan for a regional transportation and mobility system. We're going to do both.
Okay. A council committee voted unanimously this week to put a report on housing discrimination before the full council, and it addresses the issue of landlords who allegedly discriminate against tenants because of their source of income. In Vivian, which is Charlotte's housing authority, reported that in May, they reported back in May that 44% of renters with federal housing vouchers looking for a place to rent in Charlotte between April and December of 2019 were rejected because they used these federal Section 8 housing vouchers. Is that legal under federal law? Can you do that?
I don't know the legal answer to that question. So let me take it from my perspective of a city that knows that we have a huge affordable housing deficit. It may just be that we don't have the number of units that we need, that people would accept the choice vouchers to allow this to happen. So I can't address the legality of it. I'm not going to pretend to have that expertise. What I would say to you is that this is just another sign that where people need to have the ability to find a place to live is at the top of our agenda and will always be at the top of our agenda.
So the city's current fair housing ordinance provides protections for anyone within the city from discrimination based on race, religion, color, sex, national origin, familial status, or disability in all housing transactions. And the plan is for an advisory group to report back in December 2022 on whether it recommends creating a housing discrimination ordinance. If the data that brought this problem to light is from 2019, And this Fair Housing Advisory Group will report back in December 2022. Whatever they decide, if the council adopts it then, can't go into effect till 2023. That's 5 years. Is that a reasonable turnaround time for that?
I don't think that that's exactly the way that the staff framed it, but let me try. I'm going to try to reframe it in what I believe their representation was. I think that we've had a number of housing activist organizations, very progressive in pushing us very much to do this. And I think that we really have spent some time trying to figure out whether or not we had the ability to do it and whether or not it was enforceable. The acts that you read are under, that you said, all the reasons that you can't discriminate, mm-hmm. those are embedded in federal legislation. Those are the things that the Fair Housing Act covers nationally for the rest of the country, as well as Charlotte. What we're talking about is something that we don't know that whether or not it would come under the federal requirements. And so we did a survey, looked at places that it's done, and generally, there are two ways that people do this. They pass an ordinance and then they don't enforce it, or they pass an ordinance and seek approval to get it done. So what we have to do, and I think that two of our council members were pretty adamant about this, but Malcolm Graham, who chairs the Great Neighborhoods Committee, and council member Watlington, who is on that committee, they are very interested in achieving what we want to do, which is having something that's realistic and can be enforced. And that, in that case, we need a business plan, a plan that documents this. And while we have the 2019 data, it's very much, I would call, the data of the current state that people said, this is what I think, this is why I do things the way I do. It doesn't have the kind of data that would be required if we are going to have an enforceable ordinance. I think the staff said that the long-term would be, you know, up to 18 to 24 months, but they also committed to come back, and anything that worked, that they could prove workable, that they would come back immediately to do. So this is now going back to the committee. I expect in the next couple of weeks, we'll hear back from the council. I've asked Mr. Graham if he would be willing to make that happen by February the 22nd. We don't need to drag this out any further than that.
Very quickly, a quick conversation about another neighborhood that's just developed, and that is that Tent City. Powers on Facebook writes, when are we going to see literally any action on helping the people in Tent City? Not looking for the rote answers that keep being regurgitated either. There are hundreds of empty housing units in Uptown alone.
So, you know, we have said, we had a discussion about this within the council. And we have asked that we actually have the sheltering community, the county and the city, to address this issue. I believe there was a town hall meeting hosted by Commissioner George Dunlap, the chair of the county commission, along with all of these folks. This is a really difficult issue. I've worked in housing for almost 10 or 15 years. And when we start talking about the issues of the Tent City, I have to just say there are no immediate answers to very difficult cases. We have gotten it down. The last number that I was told that our in Tent City was 83. When we started out, it was, you know, many, many more. And we have offered every one of those folks an opportunity to be housed. But for various reasons, often those that are beyond our ability to understand, but have to learn to understand, those results are taking place. Other communities have done things that are very innovative. You know, for example, you know, having shelters where people with substance abuse can come in and live permanently. Having shelters where people that are afraid of being in enclosed spaces, that they have a place to put a tent that they would feel comfortable and have the facilities that make it a place where it's clean and sanitary for all. So there are lots of things that can be looked at, but this community, especially the sheltering community, which is basically the foundation for caring for the homeless, they really have to help us make some of these very tough decisions. It's not about the money, it's about how to help people that are chronically homeless and not necessarily fitting within our solutions that we have currently.
When the statues and street names and monuments celebrating the Confederacy and white supremacists and other leaders of the Jim Crow movement back in the early days of the 20th century began to come down, you appointed a legacy commission to look at Charlotte street names. And they found that most of the names on streets that were from people before the 20th century, all of those people owned slaves or participated in some way. So they identified streets that really celebrate the Confederacy, and Charlotte City Council voted unanimously this week to change the names of 9 streets. Jefferson Davis Street, which ironically is in the Druid Hills community of West Charlotte, that's a slap in the face. Stonewall Street, Pfeiffer Avenue, Acock Lane, Barringer Drive, Morrison Boulevard, Governor Morrison Street, Zebulon Avenue, West Hill Street are all names that have been slated to be changed. To what?
So it's so interesting that you mentioned Jefferson Davis Street over in the Druid Hills community, because I drove over there a few weeks ago, and the neighborhood had already changed the name. They took off the Urson, and it's now called Jeff Davis Street. And they made their decision on how they were going to do that on their own street sign. Now, I don't know about anything else. I just know that it no longer says Jefferson Davis. But there is a process to go through. You know, changing the name of a street can be more complex than people would like to think. You have, you know, the post office involvement. You have the residents. There are a lot of residents that live in some of our older community or communities that are historical, and they don't necessarily want to figure out how to get all of their addresses changed. So we have to be sensitive to this. So what we're doing is we are going to have money in our budget. I am pretty sure that the city manager will recommend money in our budget this year to help create the staff to work with communities to make these changes happen, to offset those costs, but to be able to, in the end, to take down those folks that were honored primarily during Jim Crow.
Right.
And say, no, we're not going to do this anymore. We're not going to recognize people that actually supported Jim Crow laws, that were actually fighting against the Union, that were fighting against the freedom of people that were brought here years ago and created the wealth for them. We're just not going to do that.
Well, Braxton Winston, one of your members of council, suggested that we not name any streets after people anymore. And Tariq Bakari has suggested we not name anything, not just streets, after people because of changing social attitudes. And I know that there have been names floated for these streets to be renamed. Is that a good idea to go in a different direction?
I don't know if it's a good idea. I think that we have to have some community input and discussion around that. I think that there are places that I've seen that use names. They have requirements like, you know, you must have been deceased for 10 right. years, just so that you are more sensitive to the current state of the people that live in those communities. But we've got a whole nother portion of this, which are subdivisions. All of these things are complex. I don't know the answer, whether I think it's an idea to be explored. I don't know whether it's a good idea.
Very quickly, because we're running out of time, I have less than a minute left. A lot of names have been floated, running for Richard Burr's seat, including former Mayor Patrick McCrory and former Mayor Anthony Fox and State Attorney General Josh Stein. And of course, Jeff Jackson, the state senator, has already declared. Your name has been floated. Will you be among the people running for U.S. Senate in 2 years?
You know, I've got the best job in the state right now. Love you, Governor Cooper, but I have the best job in the state as mayor of Charlotte. So that's where I am.
Okay. We didn't have time to talk about the possible delayed city council elections because of the census, but that's a topic for another day. We'll come back.
Another day, Mike. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Mayor Vi Lyles joins us once a month on this program, and today was that day. Thanks for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.